This is Juvie, a podcast that explores cases, legislation, experiences, and ramifications of children and youth in juvenile and adult criminal justice systems.
On Thursday evening, December 8th, I head out to Greaterford State Correctional Institution, 35 miles northwest of Philadelphia, to visit Giovanni Reed, the featured juvenile lifer on this podcast. I'm in Pennsylvania to attend his first status hearing the next morning in Center City, a hearing that will kick off the proceedings towards his eventual resentencing. On entry into the grim prison reception area up the railed ramp from the parking lot, I approach the registration desk and am met with a surly, uniformed woman who doesn't look round at me from her computer screen as she mumbles her desire to see my ID, against which she checks the inmate number I give her on her screen to make sure I'm on that prisoner's visiting list. She stamps the top of my hand with an invisible mark, and I shift over along the reception counter after she shoves a form at me, a form which asks for address, car tag number, and time of arrival. When I ask where to get a locker key, her voice raises minimally to a disdainful bark, indicating with a jerk of her head the glassed-off kiosk over her right shoulder. As if I should know, and I'm a moron for asking such a dumb-ass question. Duly rebuked, I sidle sheepishly to the unlit kiosk to be met through the glass with the dark shadow of another equally sullen female who gives me no acknowledgement or any other indication that she's ready to receive my $10 deposit. The passing drawer is open, so I take this as a tacit message that payment is expected immediately. I chuck in my tenner and push the drawer to. Another bark emanates from the murky kiosk. My idiocy apparently knows no bounds. She wants my ID too. When the drawer slides back towards me and I have my key and my ID back, I proceed with the list of tasks to be done before going down into the depths to meet with Giovanni. Latasha, Giovanni's main advocate, has apprised me of the precise denominations of dollar bills I need to execute efficiently the buying of snack machine and photo credit. First, I find the food credit machine. I need to put in exactly $5 to receive the card on which to put the money. The card costs $2, and $3 is added to the credit. While I'm perusing the instructions, a friendly couple about to leave donates their card to me, and I proceed to add enough credit so that Giovanni can indulge whatever snack food craving he has this evening. Then I move on to the battered photo ticket machine to find that it has paper over the slots, saying that it's broken. Oh no. I venture back to the counter to surly woman number one and ask in apologetic, cringing tone if there is an alternative solution, only to have my dumbass head bitten off again, because isn't it obvious that the completely differently shaped, sized, coloured and starred machine further along the wall is also a photo ticket machine? Damn, I should have known that immediately, shouldn't I? I skulk over to the alternative, more modern machine, obtain three $2 photo tickets, then head for the locker to stash my bag, coat, and humble pie. I don't have any pockets, so I slide my ID, the food card, and the three photo tickets down the inside of my suede ankle boot, so I'm only grasping the locker key in hand. Good job I hurried, because Giovanni's name is called immediately. Reed! And I scurry to the heavy metal windowed door that's now opened by a female guard and pass through into the visiting checkpoint antechamber. Despite Latasha having expressed some dubiousness about the metal detector missing the long piece of stainless steel hardware I have inside my left big toe, I pass through successfully, and the two contrastingly easygoing and polite female guards in this room instruct me to put my accessories into a plastic tray to be checked, only giving me a slightly curious look when I reach down into my boot to retrieve my booty, and nodding sagely when I explain myself. I pass my hand under a sensor that detects the invisible stamp I received at reception. I'm handed a slip of paper, my authorization to be in the visiting room, and the door is opened to the steep flight of concrete stairs that descends to the visiting area. At the bottom of the stairs is another heavy metal door, but it's unlocked and requires no vetting to step right through as it opens immediately into the chubby foot part of the L-shaped visiting room. A room that looks remarkably like a budget airport gate waiting area, with rows of connected and fixed plastic seats facing off to the left, down the stem of the L, which is similarly equipped with bum-numbing seating up the middle and sides of its length. Here, near the entrance in the foot part, there are vending machines around the wall to the right, and straight ahead, there's a walled platform with two beady-eyed guards facing down the long stem of the L. I see Giovanni immediately sitting in the front row, peering round at me over his left shoulder and grinning in recognition as he rises to greet me. I know him from his photos, but he's never seen me. So my first question is, how did you know it was me? And he says, who else could it be? And I suppose he's right. After all, I'm the only batty biddy coming through the door. He hands my slip of authorization paper to the guards on the platform, and we spend the next hour and a half in intense conversation, seated on a plastic chair row in front of the vending machines. We skim the surface of almost everything we've ever talked about directly in letters, on the phone, and indirectly through Latasha, snatching a hasty few minutes for many subjects, rather than lingering on one dominant issue. We have to speak loudly as the room is very noisy, a loud cacophony of chatter and laughter, occasionally punctuated by unexplained beeping sounds. I have to say, I'm completely stunned at how hearty and healthy Giovanni looks. He has the ruddy, flushed cheeks of someone who's just returned from a brisk hike on the windswept Highland Hills. His complexion is fresh and flawless, his eyes bright and alert, and he has a rack of perfectly positioned, ivory, unstained teeth that belie the notoriously perfunctory and infrequent dental care of state correctional institutions. He looks a decade younger than his 42 years and has a genteel and gentle demeanour. He's relaxed, smiling and cheery, and certainly doesn't emanate an aura of downtrodden bitterness or weariness. In fact, there's a surprising lack of oppressiveness in the room in general. Brown jumpsuited prisoners moving around freely, some standing, some seated, lounging back or leaning forward, elbows on their knees as they talk in unhushed tones to their wives, girlfriends, brothers, fathers, and a handful of small children. The scene has the look and atmosphere of a military airport departure lounge, with families spending a last hour with soon-to-be-deployed servicemen who are distinguishable from their loved ones only by their uniforms. Giovanni tells me that these brown coveralls are only worn in the visiting area, and that back on the block he wears regular, if generic, trousers, T-shirts and his own shoes, clothes that wouldn't look out of place on the outside, but that are nevertheless similar to all prisoners, so that they're quickly distinguishable from staff members. Gone are the days when inmates could wear anything they wanted. I comment to Giovanni that as an outsider, it's remarkable to think that this is his normal life, not some temporary extraordinary circumstance taking him momentarily out of his ordinary routine and environment. He reminds me of the Morgan Freeman line in The Shawshank Redemption about coming to depend on the walls after a long time inside them. He says that's very true. This is typical of Giovanni. While he sometimes expresses his own personal hopes and frustrations, he's also pragmatic and even philosophical, able to see the positive side to a fundamentally unpalatable situation. He's keen to be released and excited at the prospect of coming back into society, hopefully in the not-too-distant future. But he's also sad that he'll be leaving behind friends and that he won't be around to help some of them understand the legal complexities of their cases, something he's taken on due to his years of intensive, if informal, study of law in the prison library. Just in front of the surveillance platform, there's a raised dais with a couple of small plastic kiddie chairs and a large hanging drape on which there's a facsimile of something resembling a palace in ancient Rome. This is the backdrop for photographs. A prisoner collects the tickets and takes our photographs. Giovanni strikes a regal pose in front of the opulent fake scene for his solo shot, looking as confident and distinguished as an emperor. When the buzzer goes off, indicating it's time to leave, Giovanni retrieves my paper authorization from the guards and we say our goodbyes. There's no authoritarian calling out or rounding up of prisoners to march them back to the blocks. No one's guarding the metal door to the staircase to make sure no one tries to pull a fast one. I head back upstairs and notice that other visitors are handing in their slips of paper to the female guard at the top, and I realise that Giovanni forgot to give mine back to me. I head back downstairs and find him seated casually across from another prisoner in animated conversation. He's clutching my authorization slip in his hand, folded into four. I tease him about sneaking away with my exit document, a joke that would be awkward and out of place if it weren't for the fact that he will be resentenced in the next few months, and in one way or another will soon rejoin the world he left behind more than 25 years ago. That's why I'm here in Pennsylvania this Thursday night, because the following morning, Friday the 9th, things finally kick off for Giovanni, a brief, procedural, uneventful court hearing in Center City, Philadelphia, that he doesn't attend, but that I'm here to attend. No, nothing of great import happens, except the next court date being scheduled, but it is nevertheless an important milestone, and it's the first step on his path to freedom. Giovanni's 85-year-old dad, Pop Jimmy Reed, is there. He's a little overwhelmed by all the legal niceties of the upcoming procedures, but that really doesn't matter. All he knows is that his youngest son will soon be home, and there's a decided pep to his stride as he and I leave the courthouse and head to Reading Terminal Market to pick up some eggs, and then go for a chinwag and some coffee in the market diner. Afterwards, I give him a ride home back to the South Philly senior living apartment where I interviewed him over 4 months ago. His mood is decidedly more cheerful than it was then. Now he's got something concrete to hold on to. He'll definitely be striding with gusto to the bus stop to get to Center City, Philly on January 13th for that next hearing. Last Friday, Giovanni had a hearing. Can you explain exactly what its purpose was?
The hearing is called a status hearing, and the purpose was to literally just get the status of this particular juvenile lifer defendant.
What were they looking for in that first hearing?
They wouldn't be looking for anything in particular. Everyone has a different situation, so this is the first opportunity to get the status of the person. What is their name, and where are they from, and how long have they been in prison, and what prison are they currently incarcerated in? Initial basic information.
Right. Yes, because that's pretty much all that happened, apart from setting the next date, which is the January 13th hearing.
Yes, these are all status hearings. Ultimately, the resulting hearing would be a sentencing hearing, but up to that point, these would be considered status hearings.
But the next hearing goes into a bit more depth than happened last Friday. They're asking for documentation.
Yes, and there again, it's not so much a proceeding that's occurring, but I think it's more so a way to hold parties accountable. So they just set a status hearing date to ensure that both sides are doing whatever is necessary. So by the next status date, the Commonwealth will have turned over to Giovanni's team the homicide file. So that is the next scheduled event, which should occur by the January 13th court date.
Is that all that should have been handed over by that date?
From my understanding, that is what the next date was to make sure occurred, was the handing over of the homicide file.
Is that the only document that would be required to be handed over?
My understanding is that the court ordered the Commonwealth to turn over the homicide file, and that's all that I'm aware of at this time.
Can you explain what the homicide file is?
Well, I've never laid eyes on one, but it is the file that would have been maintained at the time of the defendant's trial, even pretrial, the time of the arrest, the time that the crime was committed. So there could be all sorts of documents and information contained in the file. And I would also imagine that it would be probably a compilation of police paperwork from the police department, as well as the Commonwealth's office.
Now, what time frame will the homicide file cover? You say it's from the initial arrest, but will it contain any documents that were added in the years afterwards in appeals and other hearings?
It may, and that's why it's important that they get that turned over so that we can inspect it and see what all it contains.
It'll no doubt have a lot of things in it that the defense has never seen.
It may. It may. It's one of those things, you know, you just never know. That's why the court orders that it be turned over. What's important is that whenever a defendant enters into any type of agreement with regard to a conviction or a sentence, it's important that he do so knowingly, meaning that he's aware of everything that he needs to be aware of, that he's also knowledgeable about everything that the Commonwealth knows about his situation. It's just important to know what all is out there so that people can make intelligent decisions with regard to sentencing moving forward.
Now, why would this homicide file not have been handed over to the defense during all his various appeals and evidentiary hearings?
Well, we've never been at this point. As you know, Montgomery decision came down in January, and so he's never been in a situation where he's been entitled to a new sentence. And so here we are. And so it's important to know what all is involved in moving forward with considering any type of agreement with regards to a new sentence. A court could order it if there's reason to believe that there's something within a file that may have been not turned over, information that could exculpate the defendant. But that's not the situation here. This is strictly a sentencing matter moving forward in light of Miller and Montgomery. And so that's why we would be at this juncture with the homicide file. The defendant is not entitled to relitigate his case once he's been convicted. So in order for a court to grant such a request, there has to be overwhelming evidence that would support such a ruling. This is new, so we'll see how they fine-tune procedures moving forward. The Commonwealth versus Batts case was recently argued before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And so we'll see if in their ruling, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court comes up with some guidelines for trial courts to follow moving forward. So we'll just have to see. But as of now, that's what has been the process, at least in Philadelphia County. Batts was a juvenile lifer, is a juvenile lifer, and he was sentenced to a mandatory life sentence some years ago. And while he was on appeal of his judgment of sentence, Miller versus Alabama came down from the United States Supreme Court in the summer of 2012.
Miller being the Supreme Court ruling that mandatory life without parole for juveniles is unconstitutional.
Because Batts was in the process of litigating or contesting his judgment of sentence, he was able to reap the benefit of the Miller ruling. And so he did not need to wait for a finding of retroactive application because his appeal process was not yet over. So he wouldn't need a retroactive application of Miller. And so pursuant to Miller, he did have a sentencing hearing, and I would imagine evidence was presented to mitigate, and ultimately the trial judge sentenced him again to life without parole. This time, not as a mandatory sentence because Miller invalidated mandatory life without parole sentences, but after having convened a sentencing hearing and taking testimony, the judge found that Batts was still worthy of a life without parole sentence.
So he was deemed incorrigible.
I would imagine so, yes. And so he appealed his new life sentence. And so that is what was recently on argument before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court just a couple of weeks ago. And so we'll now await their ruling to see what procedural safeguards they're going to put in place or just how they're going to handle life sentences for juveniles moving forward in Pennsylvania. It's really hard to say how impactful their ruling can be on sentences of the past. So we'll really have to wait and see just how they handle that.
Now, after the January 13th date for Giovanni, where we have the homicide file handed over, what's the next step?
It really depends, but just judging by what's been happening in other cases, the district attorney would likely need time to review Giovanni's prison files and records. Then after that, I would imagine that they would need some time to prepare an offer to present to Giovanni. And then after that, I would imagine he would need some time to consider any offer they should present. And then after that, one of two things could happen. If he were to accept the offer, he'd accept it and a date would be set for him to be formally resentenced. And then if he were to reject the offer, a date would be set for him to come to court for a sentencing hearing where he would put on evidence and present witness testimony as to why he should be sentenced accordingly so that he would be released immediately. And that's pretty much how the process should go. That's how it's been happening thus far in other cases. So I would imagine something similar would take place for Giovanni. If he wanted to contest any part of the sentence to include parole time, he would do that.
You mentioned that there would be a period after the next hearing that's on January 13th where the district attorney would be considering all the documents and coming up with an offer. During that period, the defense has in its hands the homicide file for the first time, presumably. What is the advantage potentially to the defense, to Giovanni's attorneys, to have in their hand this homicide file during that waiting period where we wait for the district attorney to come up with an offer? What would his attorneys be doing with that homicide file?
Any defendant that's considering any type of plea arrangement, any type of sentencing arrangement, has to do so knowingly. And knowingly would consist of that person having the knowledge, the information, and access to the knowledge and information that the government has. And so this is a way to ensure that Giovanni is making any decision or going into any negotiations knowing what the government knows.
What time frame do you expect the district attorney to take after the January 13th hearing to come up with an offer?
It really depends. Giovanni is of the first group of people in Philadelphia County where they began to, you know, roll out these status hearings. And so there's not a lot of history to go on, not too many patterns to take a look at. It would just really depend. There's a lot of parties involved between the court, the district attorney, Giovanni's attorney, his mitigation specialist. So, you know, you have to make sure that people's calendars are open. So there's a lot involved in the scheduling process. I would imagine maybe a couple of months, but I don't know.
During that waiting period where the district attorney is coming up with his sentence, would there be any potential meetings between Giovanni's attorneys, his mitigation specialist, and the Commonwealth, the district attorney?
Well, I'm sure if there was a need, it wouldn't be unheard of. But I don't know that there would necessarily be a need, but the parties would certainly be free to talk or meet as they needed.
So Giovanni's attorney would be at liberty if he found something in the homicide file that he wanted to question. He would be at liberty to contact the district attorney and arrange a meeting.
I think attorneys, especially two professionals, particularly when they're cordial, I think that happens quite a bit where attorneys meet to hash out different details. So I don't think that would be unheard of or uncommon. The district attorney on the case is not the district attorney for the county of Philadelphia. This person is an assistant, what they call assistant district attorneys in Philadelphia County, which is a function of the Commonwealth. So it would be whatever entity prosecuted you. Typically, it is your county, but sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes a state prisoner was prosecuted by the state attorney general's office.
Will you be going to the January 13th hearing?
Maybe.
It's on a Friday. Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always an interesting date that pops up.
Yeah. So have you spoken to Giovanni?
Not recently, no. I have been buried in finals.
Latasha is graduating with her law degree from Widener University Commonwealth Law School in Harrisburg this coming May. She hopes Giovanni will be out in time to be able to attend her graduation ceremony. Let's see how things progress after January 13th. Who knows what Giovanni's status will be 5 months from now?
You've been listening to Juvie, conceived, written, and produced by Zoe Badafinic. Join us next time on Juvie.